You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Albert Breer, senior NFL reporter and lead content strategist for the Monday Morning Quarterback, joining us on the program. Albert, where do you want to start?
You want to you want a good theory on why the longer extra points mess with kickers?
Sure.
So, like, what I've heard from a few special teams coaches over the last few years that I think is sort of interesting is that kickers used to use the extra point to work out kinks. So if they felt something was a little off or they thought this or that was wrong, the extra point gave them an in-game opportunity to sort of work on something that wasn't that was either wrong or didn't feel quite right, you know, within their stroke. And so you take that away from them, and now all of a sudden it sort of messes with the whole equilibrium of being a kicker, and they don't have an in-game opportunity to sort of work out things that they did before. So I don't know. That's just one theory out there that I thought was kind of interesting, and in that, like, you know, kicking such a mental game, and, you know, they used to have, each guy used to have this outlet where he could kind of work on things, and now that outlet's been taken away.
I wish there was a deep dive, a study of kickers, where you just got into their heads of what they go through, because they're really ostracized. You know, they're not really a football player until they come into a game and they can win or lose a game. And I can't imagine Mason Crosby yesterday that you're missing these field goals. You don't miss field goals. Then you got to go out there and kick another field goal. Just the whole mind game that is played, that kickers, you know, play with themselves. I don't know. It's something that is probably not quantifiable in trying to understand what these guys go through every day or every week.
Yeah, and I talked to him after the game, which was, it was interesting because I asked him about this conversation he had with Matt LaFleur. And he had missed, he hadn't just missed three straight kicks, Dan, he'd missed like kicks on three straight possessions, right? So the Packers had three possessions in a row that ended with missed field goals. And on top of that, the other kicker had missed a couple, which, I mean, just sort of, I think would add to it, you know, like that this is just really weird. What's going on in the stadium? And LaFleur comes over to him and says, like, what do you think? And he said, I got this. And it wasn't a short field goal either. I think it was, what, 49 yards? And so, you know, I mean, I think like there's like this, I guess it's almost like, I think the best way to the best thing to compare it to is being a golfer, right? Like a golfer who can compartmentalize just kind of a slump. And, you have three, four bad holes in a row, and somehow where the rest of us would be out there and we'd be all over the place on the fourth or fifth hole in that string, the best kickers have an ability to compartmentalize struggles, maybe the way that a good golfer does. And it's, I think the other thing that's sort of interesting in comparing the two is just being a little bit off can mean everything is wrong, you know? And so I just think the psychology of the kickers really, really interesting. And you think back to some of the guys like Scott Norwood, where one kick just like sort of like, who was a really good kicker, just basically ended his career. He never got it right after that. And then you think about a guy who's, you know, missing kicks on three straight possessions, and he's playing on a team where, you know, every loss could be one more or one, every loss could be one fewer game at Lambeau in January. The pressure of that and everything else, being able to compartmentalize it, that's definitely a skill.
Yeah, with a golfer, you got to play your misses. You know, as they always talk about, a kicker doesn't get that opportunity. If you miss, then you get another chance to go up and go, oh, we'll be able to try that again. The worst loss yesterday was turned in by?
The worst loss yesterday. You know, I don't think the Chiefs losing to the Bills was a bad loss per se, but I like think that this is sort of reason for concern now. They've lost 3 of 5, and some of the pieces that they've brought in aren't coming together the way that maybe they'd hoped they'd had. They're older on, you know, in some positions, with guys like Tyrann Mathieu and Frank Clark are getting a little bit further on in years on defense, and then younger in other positions on defense with guys like Nick Bolton. And then they've got all these new guys on the offensive line. I wonder how it's going to come together. I wonder how long it's going to take to come together. Cause I think anybody who's paying attention to what the Chiefs did this offseason knew it might take a little while for all of that to come together. But I don't know if they expected that they would get their doors blown off by Buffalo in week 5. And so, I just think the process in Kansas City is taking a little bit longer. I don't know. There's not like a particularly like embarrassing loss.
I thought the Raiders losing to the Bears, and they had a good September. We were talking about Derek Carr, MVP, and now you lose to Justin Fields at home.
And let's not ignore the elephant on the couch there either. I mean, you know, like, you know, John Gruden going through, you know, what he's gone through the last 3 days. And the fact that, like, I think that a lot of people across the league, not just people in the Raiders building, but people across the league were paying attention. Like, how is that team going to respond to him now? You know, because, I mean, something like this happens. And I think the honest question for everybody in that locker room is, well, if he put that in an email, what else is he saying? And I'm not calling John a liar. I don't know, you know, whether or not, you know, what he's saying is genuine, that, you know, it wasn't a racial comment and he didn't mean it that way. But I mean, there are going to be guys in that locker room who are probably asking that question. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's like in the same way, I think, like, we had to kind of watch not just like whether or not Jacksonville won the game yesterday, but like the effort and how much fight there was. Like, I think it's fair to look at the same things with the Raiders on Sunday and kind of look at it and think, how are you going to come out of this? So, yeah, I mean, that's a disappointing loss for the Raiders. The Bears aren't a bad team, though. I think we've kind of gotten into this space where people think the Bears are a bad team, and they've been to the playoffs 2 times in the last 3 years. They're top 10 in the NFL in wins since 2018. So I don't think that's a bad team, but I do agree that, like, I think coming off of what the team was coming off of with everything that happened with Gruden on Friday and sort of the fallout the last couple of days, it was important for them to play well, and they didn't play very well.
I'm just wondering, the NFL is going to investigate. But how far do you investigate? Because when you start to look at email, there's probably a lot of things in a lot of emails that if you start to go, I mean, how deep do you go and what do you want to find out? Because sometimes you may not want to find out certain things here. And I wonder if they suspend him, if the Raiders suspend him, how much, you know, how heavy-handed is the NFL here?
Yeah, and I don't even know. Like, I don't know. You know, like how you would go about looking through text messages. Like, can you look up text messages from 10 years ago?
Well, I don't think you can do text messages. They're available from what I'm told, but email, that's something different than, and Bruce Allen, who's on the receiving end of this, you know, he didn't push back on, you know, John, you shouldn't say that. Like, it just starts to expand a little bit. It's not just John Gruden.
And honestly, like, Dan, it goes back to everything that's happened the last 4 or 5 years in the league, you know, with Kaepernick in 2016. And then, you know, the comments that Bob McNair made. And, you know, I think with every one of these, the question is, if he feels comfortable saying it in setting X, what is he saying in setting Y and setting Z, you know? And so, you know, like, I think you're onto it, like where you say, how much do they really want to know? Are they wanting to dig through John Gruden's text messages from 2011 and his emails from 2011? And then if they find something there, are they going through other interactions? I mean, it can wind up being a never ending thing. I will say this though, you know, I think there were, because, and there's natural distrust between players in the league, right? Like, that exists. It's always exists. It's just the way it is. Like, I think that there were a fair number of players who looked at the way that the NFL handled everything in 2020 and liked it and thought, like, you're trying to do some good here, but still sort of wondered how much of this is just about the moment the country's in and how much of this is just about, you know, public relations and making sure that they're not creating, you know, they're not creating a problem for themselves. And so, you know, I do know that there are at least some players, even some coaches, even some executives that, like, looked at the league's effort in 2020 and said, well, let's just see what happens. Let's see how they handle, you know, some of these situations in the future. And I think some of those people are definitely looking and saying, all right, like, let's see what they do with a prominent coach. And are they willing to come down on a prominent coach in a situation like this?
If this was the NBA, what do you think happens if something was unearthed by an owner, about an owner?
Okay, without having covered it, my guess would be that there would be prominent players, like the most prominent players in the league, out front and talking about it on social media. That'd be my guess, right? Like, and I don't know, you've been around that stuff probably more than me, been around the NBA more than me, but my guess is you probably have guys like LeBron James and Kevin Durant, like openly commenting on it. Right.
Yeah.
And like, once that happens, now we're talking about something else, because now it's, you know, now it's sort of pitting players against the league, and the players have put the league on notice. And I think, you know, for a league that's as rabbit-eared as the NFL is, if you had players coming out and saying something and turning it into a discussion point in their circles, like, now we're talking about something else. That's like how, you know, that's how it, you know, happened when, that's how the Houston thing became what it became with Bob McNair, you know, is that you had guys like Dwayne Brown and DeAndre Hopkins that, you know, like literally were like, I don't want to play for that guy anymore. And that's how that became a bigger thing. So I think, you know, in situations like this, the players, and I'm not just talking about the Raiders players, Dan, in situations like this, players have more power than maybe they even think they do. And that, like, if it becomes a discussion point and a public discussion point in their circles, things can wind up happening. And I think that if this was a more public discussion point with, you know, say quarterbacks, and quarterbacks were talking about it publicly on social media, the league would probably be acting, would be reacting in a little bit more of an aggressive fashion.
He's Albert Breer, the Monday Morning Quarterback, senior NFL reporter. The Jags lose to the Titans. They've got a game in London coming up, and then they have a bye week. Where are we headed? What happens during that bye week, if anything, to Urban Meyer?
I still think that the intention is to go forward with him as the head coach. You know, however, I know this, like, part of the reason they hired Urban in the first place is because I think Shad Khan to some degree was embarrassed with the results that he'd gotten and was embarrassed with the direction of the franchise and had sort of recognized, I've got too many things that have been a certain way in this organization, and I need to bring in a change agent and have someone in here who's going to shake the whole place up. And so, you know, I think, like, kind of like feeling that his organization was regarded a certain way in 2020 is why Urban Meyer is there in 2021, because he wanted to change things. Now, like, now there's another reason now for him to feel like, you know, like his franchise is being viewed that way. They invested deeply in Urban Meyer, Dan. Like, when Urban went there, the conditions were, I need staff, and not just coaching staff, but support staff. You know, Shad did all of that. I need a practice facility. I need a first-class practice facility. They're building a $150 million practice facility. So they're deeply invested in Urban Meyer. That's why it's hard for me to see them pulling the plug. Mm. But that was a pretty strong statement that he put out there. And so I think, you know, being on that national stage, even though it's, I mean, it's a London game, but being like on that, in that standalone game in that spot, I think it's an important spot for Urban Meyer. And I think that they have to at least play well in that spot. You know, and for him to sort of, I think, cool things off a little bit there. My guess is that, you know, I think Urban's got too much pride to walk away this early. And you remember, like, when he walked away at Florida and Ohio State, was after a whole lot of success. And I think that, you know, Shad Khan, you know, given his druthers, wants to see this through. But a lot of this, and Urban's right when he says this, a lot of this rides on how the locker room,
yeah,
you know, decides to handle it and whether or not they remain engaged going forward. And I think, you know, the trip to London, historically, if you look at it, because it's hard going over there, has sort of shown us where coaches stand over the years.
Yeah, I think you bring up the great point, and that's effort. If the team continues to at least try, give effort on the field, that's one thing, you know, that they don't quit on him. I'll leave you with this. The odds of Trayvon Diggs winning the NFL Defensive Player of the Year.
You know, I think he's got a chance. I just think that at that position, it's so hard. Like, Darrelle Revis never won it. Jalen Ramsey hasn't won it. Like, we're talking about great, like, I mean, Revis is a Hall of Famer. Ramsey's trending that way. And you know what the hard thing about it is, Dan, is the statistics, is that he's got six picks now, but what happens when teams start throwing away from him, you know? And so I think he's got a really good shot to be first team all pro. But the question becomes, if he has, say, just one or two picks over his last 10 games, which could mean he's playing fantastic and no one's throwing at him. Yeah. Like, then I think too many of the voters are going to look at that and say, well, wait a second. Like, can we give the award to somebody who wasn't making plays in the ball in November and December, even though that can be a symbol of how well a corner is playing.
But he's playing for the Cowboys.
That's true. Yeah.
You got to factor that in. They didn't have any defense.
Revis never won it.
I know.
I mean, that's crazy. Think about that. Darrell Revis never won it. Like it's just, I think it's hard for guys at that position to do it, you know?
But Stephon Gilmore won it.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So
he's got a shot. He's got a shot, Dan. he's got a shot. I would just say, like, if you look at Stephon Gilmore, the other thing that Gilmore had going for him, that was a really good secondary that he was a part of in New England, right? And so it was harder to throw away from Stephon Gilmore in New England than maybe it was to throw away from Darrell Revis in New York or Champ Bailey, you know, who was a great player for a lot of years. Hard to throw away from Champ Bailey for a lot of years in Denver. Or easier to throw away. Easier to throw away. Yeah. Like, I think with Trayvon Diggs, it's going to be a little easier for teams to kind of work around throwing at him versus what it was for, say, Steph Gilmore in 2019.
You're a buzzkill, man. You're a buzzkill. Buzzkill Breer. That's what they're calling it.
So you're rooting for Trayvon then?
No, I just look for impact players. That defense was one of the worst that we've seen in NFL history. Micah Parsons has been a godsend for them, but you have somebody who's changing games out of nowhere. And a second-round pick, good story.
He's spectacular, too. That's the one thing that will help him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, spectacular from, like, a highlight player. So I'm with you on that. Like, I hope he keeps making plays like this because it's fun to watch. I don't know. Like, I think what often happens, I'm just telling you, I think what often happens with corners is, you know, teams start throwing away from them.
Good to talk to you, Albert.
Sorry to kill the buzz.
That's all right. Usually it's the guys I work with that kill my buzz, but it's you today. Albert, thank you for joining us.
All right, thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern, or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. This guy is the voice of the SEC. He's Paul Feinbaum, Paul Feinbaum Show on ESPN Radio, and he joins us on the program. Was it a good weekend for college football, Paul?
If all you folks in Alabama turn your radio down for a second, it was a spectacular weekend. Dan, I saw some guy did a compilation. I don't know how he did it, but he said this was one of the 8 or 9 most exciting days in the history of college football. And to think about when that game that you just referenced ended in Dallas at 3:30, it was one of the most spectacular comebacks ever for Oklahoma. To think that wouldn't be the best game in the state of Texas that day is truly remarkable. Speaking of College Station, October 8th was a day that all Aggie fans circled. And I do this, we do this traveling SEC show like College Game Day. And I think when we picked on Sunday, it was like the fifth best game of the weekend in the SEC because nobody thought A&M was going to win. It wasn't because, you know, they don't have a good program. They just got through losing to Arkansas and Mississippi State. I mean, they were done.
Yeah, I felt the same way. And then all of a sudden, I mean, we have so many great stories now in college football, but I wonder if they're real stories. Is Iowa a top five team in your opinion? Is Cincinnati a top five team? If the season ended today, do you really think the committee is going to have Iowa and Cincinnati in the Final Four?
No, I was talking to somebody earlier and they said unequivocally Cincinnati has to be in the college football playoff. I'm like, going, that's great. It's Columbus Day. And that does not mean anything because there are so many other things that could happen. And I'm not going to bore you with the playoff predictor, but all Alabama has to do, Dan, is win out. And I know for most schools, that sounds like a big hill to climb. For Alabama, it's not. They win the rest of the regular season games and beat Georgia. They're in. That also means Georgia would be in, assuming they don't lose to some ridiculous upset. So then you only have two spots left. So, you know, Cincinnati better have a bulldozer to knock that door down if that's going to be the case.
What happened to Clemson?
I think it's been coming for a while. They lost one of their coordinators to USF a couple of years ago, and I think it affected their play calling a little bit. I think sometimes these things get stale. And you know, they lost a collection of quarterbacks that go by the name of Deshaun Watson and Trevor Lawrence. And I think just to expect the next guy is going to walk in there. And they also forgot to recruit premier offensive linemen. And when you're a new quarterback, that does not work very well.
What happened to LSU?
What happened to LSU is that Joe Burrow left, and so did about six or seven other first round picks. And just because you recruit five stars doesn't mean you develop them. I mean, since Joe Burrow left his last game, Ed Ogeron is 8-8, and it's about to get worse because they have Florida, Alabama, Arkansas, and Ole Miss and A&M. And I'm not even sure they're going to have a winning season. And it, as crazy as this may sound, Dan, not to you, you follow college football in the South. 2 years after before the 2 year anniversary of a national championship, Coach O could be out. And if you ask, has that ever happened before? Yes, it happened before. 2012, Gene Chizik fired. Who was his quarterback 2 years earlier? Cam Newton.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. Paulie and I were that, you know, you lose that quarterback, but you lose Burrow, you lose your quarterback's coach as well with Joe Burrow.
Yeah.
And I was told that, you know, Coach O is going to be out because unless he would somehow be able to land Arch Manning, that, you know, the sweepstakes are pretty high with Alabama, Clemson, Texas might be the front runners for Arch Manning. But I don't know. I just can't imagine that Coach O is going to survive even after 2 years here.
I think Arch Manning's still in the eighth grade. Yeah. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I don't think he'll be around. They love this guy, and you probably have interviewed him before. He's hard not to like, but I think he's a very average football coach, and LSU needs something spectacular, and they do not have that right now.
Are you all in on the Big Ten?
I'm starting to watch a lot more Big Ten Network. It took me a long time to find it, Dan, but the Big Ten is the story of college football. I'm sure I'll get a pink slip today from the SEC Network for saying that, but hey, I'm sure they're not paying attention right now. And yeah, there are so many great stories, and I think the story that we buried 5 weeks ago may come back and be the Big Ten champion, and that's Ohio State. They are looking alive again. And I think the schedule suits them quite nicely.
Are you all in on Michigan? Your good buddy Jim Harbaugh.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just thinking, Dan. I need some help here because you've handed out NBA trophies and NFL trophies, and I've never really had to deal with stuff like that. But if somehow Jim Harbaugh wins the national championship, I'm looking for a country to evacuate to. I just don't think it's going to be safe for the two of us to live in the great United States of America.
If you ran USC's football program or USC athletics, what would you do as your head coach?
I would hire James Franklin. I think he checks a lot of boxes in the sense that he's a very good CEO, which means he'll bring in a top flight staff. And from there, I think this program needs to run like a big time operation. And it hasn't been. And I think some of the problem is they've had inept athletic directors out there in the past. They don't anymore. They hired Mike Bone from Cincinnati. And in LA, Dan, you have to be able to schmooze, and James Franklin is very smooth. And I expect that program to come back big, and I think he would be the best choice.
Every time I bring this up, because I had a source who told me that whenever they fired Clay, hey, James Franklin's top's on their list. And then the people at Penn State are mad at me because I bring up James Franklin. And I'm thinking, take it as a compliment. Like, your coach will be in demand. He's either going to get a new contract at Penn State or he'll get a contract at USC.
Can't believe college football fans get mad at commentators for speaking the truth. That's a new one. If I'm over at Penn State right now, I'd be searching the yellow pages for a new coach because I think Franklin is leaving.
Paul, always great to talk to you. Thank you, buddy.
Dan, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR or stream us live every day at youtube.com/The Dan Patrick Show.
He's Mike Harmon. I'm Dan Byer. We have a brand new fantasy football podcast called I Want Your Flex. Twice a week, every Tuesday and Friday, we come up with new episodes to not only look back at what happened, what you need to do at that minute, and also look ahead of what's coming up in the fantasy football world.
That's right, Dan. Every week, we're going to scour the waiver wire to find the pickups to turbo boost your fantasy lineup, sits, starts, fantasy football players' rankings to get you ready to dominate the competition.
Listen to I Want Your Flex with Mike Harmon and me, Dan Byer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I wanted to play this from Urban Meyer's press conference yesterday because the Jags had a 4th-and-1, and I guess most people thought it was going to be a quarterback sneak with Trevor Lawrence, but here's Urban Meyer talking about his quarterback.
The quarterback sneak, he's not quite comfortable with it yet. We've been practicing that. I know that might sound silly, but when you've never done it, it's something that we need to continue to make that so you can make that call in that critical situation.
All right. And as you might guess, this is in college. This is the pros where we get to hear from the players themselves. And Trevor Lawrence was asked about that.
Trevor, going back to that goal line play, coach just said that you guys are still working on quarterback sneaks. Do you feel comfortable being under center in that situation for a quarterback sneak, or is that something you guys are still working on?
No, I feel comfortable. Obviously I haven't really ran it before in a game, but no, I feel comfortable. It's something we've worked, so we all can get better. But no, QB sneak is always something that we can get to, and I feel comfortable with.
Let's bring in Carson Palmer. Help me understand this. Most of these guys get in a spread offense when they're in junior high, high school, college, and not normally under center. How big a deal is this that a quarterback, they're not comfortable running a quarterback sneak?
Well, I just think all of this is getting misconstrued a bit. Dan, have you ever seen the movie Heat, the Al Pacino movie, The Heat?
Yeah.
I think Urban's got the heat on him right now. And everything he says is going to be calculated and maybe misconstrued a bit. I just think his point was, look, we haven't run it in a game yet. I wasn't comfortable with the call on 4th-and-1. I'd be more comfortable if we'd run it a couple times. But I don't think in any way he was saying Trevor's not tough enough. He's scared of running it. I don't think that was his point. And I think that's what Trevor was saying is, look, you know, I'm ready for it. We haven't practiced it, and I haven't run it in a game a bunch. But at the end of the day, Urban's got the heat on him, and everything he says right now is going to be, you know, overthought and talked about by everybody. I don't think there's anything really to this.
I understand it, but here's Tom Brady, who's still running a quarterback sneak at age 44. Why can't I have a 6'6", 23-year-old run a quarterback sneak? Like, is it just getting under center? Like, why haven't they practiced this, though? That quarterback sneak is really important to a lot of quarterbacks.
Unfortunately, you can't practice it, just like you can't practice with a quarterback being live in the pocket with the starting defense breathing down his neck, lighting him up in practice. You're just not going to expose your quarterback to injury practicing a quarterback sneak in the game. At the end of the day, they need to be in the first quarter on 3rd-and-1/2 yard or 3rd-and-1 and run it a couple times to where they're able and comfortable enough running it on 4th-and-1 with the game on the line. But you cannot practice it. I've never practiced it in my career. I've never seen it practiced in my career. It's just something you got to call in a game, and that's your practice.
What is it like, though, when you go, and I'm just trying to envision this, when Brady goes to the line, and we know he's going to get the ball in the quarterback sneak, but as far as tapping, you know, your center's rear end on the right or left, if you're going to go, or how that works with the unspoken communication?
Yeah, as you come up to line of scrimmage, you're looking for a double team, meaning your center and guard on one defensive football player. So wherever that nose guard is, the guy that's closest, the defender closest to the center lines up. If he's on the left shoulder or the right shoulder, you just tap him on the butt and let that guard on that side also know that, hey, I want you two to double team that guy, and I'm going to just ride the wave. I'm going to get on the top of your back and push and we're actually going to triple team that individual player. So it's like I said, it's just something that they actually need to practice it in a game. And that's the only opportunity they're going to have to practice it.
I was just surprised that Urban didn't shake it off better.
Like Urban's Belichick. Got the heat on him, man.
I know, but Belichick would have diffused that. He would have pushed that to the side and moved on because, you know, in college, you wouldn't get to talk to the quarterback. In the pros, Trevor probably didn't know what Urban said. He's coming in next, and, of course, they're going to ask him about that. I don't know. It just felt like it was a rookie mistake for the head coach.
It's exactly what it was. I mean, Urban's got the heat on him. Everything he says is going to be analyzed and over-scrutinized, and he hasn't built up the equity that Belichick has. He hasn't earned the right to just kind of brush off a simple question by somebody and move on to the next one. He's got the heat on him. Every question is going to be overanalyzed, and you're right. That was a rookie mistake the way he handled that.
All in on the Chargers?
I'm all in on the Chargers because they can rush the passer, and they got one of the best young QBs in the league. I mean, that combination, big, physical, hard-to-cover receivers. Keenan Allen is still one of the best-kept secrets in the league. I still don't understand why he doesn't quite get the love that some of these other guys do in the league. He's been doing it for a long time at a very high level. But they can rush the passer with Bosa, and they can throw the ball on anybody. I mean, Justin Herbert, everybody knows it. He's a star. He's a star in the making. So I'm all in on the Chargers, absolutely.
Okay, but what do you see with Justin Herbert? Because Jimmy Johnson on Fox's pregame show said he would take Justin Herbert over Patrick Mahomes.
That may be a stretch. I mean, Justin Herbert hasn't done it as many times as Patrick has, but I'm not saying that I don't know that Justin Herbert has the ability to win a Super Bowl the talent to win a Super Bowl. We're about to find out this season. But man, the ball comes out of his hands so effortlessly. There's so much zip and acceleration on the football coming off of his fingertips, and he can take off and run. I mean, you saw him use his legs. He is a complete threat. Run it, throw it. He's smart. He's actually does a really, really good job for a young quarterback too. He does not panic. There's a lot of times where he held on the ball for a little bit too late. And then you see that quarterback that's young, that tries to throw it away at the end, and a guy tips it and it becomes a pick or it becomes a fumble. He's really, really calm in bad situations and knows when to just eat it and live for another play and take the sack and move on to second and 16. So I just really like the temperament that he's playing with right now.
What would concern you about the Chiefs?
Just defense. I mean, they're obviously built with speed on the back end. If you look at the back end of that defense, there's not a defender over 210 pounds. They're built to stop the pass. You know, you get in situations against them late in the season, especially, and with the weather last night, the wind, the rain, you got to be able to run the ball, you know, forcefully down people's throats. And that's the one thing that Kansas City can't really stop right now is you can attack them in the run game. They are built to stop the pass because they're really building around Patrick, obviously. And, you know, they want to be in a situation where they're up 28-17 or 35-21, where they force the opposing offense into a throwing game. But last night you saw them get exposed. I mean, they hung 38 points on them last night. And Patrick isn't going to be able to keep up with every single opposing offense every week. There's going to be games like that. But I'm saying all that, I don't think that I'm not saying that the Chiefs aren't going to make a run at it. I think they're going to be deep, you know, deep in the playoffs at the end of this season. But that's definitely a concern, is the amount of points that have been hung on them early on this year.
I've had this philosophy with the Chiefs, but tell me how, and maybe it sounds simplistic and it's not, but I would have my defense, my backs play deep. Like, I would never let Tyreek Hill beat me. I want everything in front of me. You want to get 10 yarders, 15 yarders, fine. We're going to take advantage of your defense. When you're on the field, they like to strike quick, and I want to know if they have the patience to be able to do something like that. And that is no home runs. You want to hit doubles? Hit doubles. And make them value every possession they have that they have to score because your defense isn't that good. Is that too simplistic going against the Chiefs?
Well, I think the issue with playing them like that is Travis Kelce. If Travis Kelce's injured and he isn't available to work the underneath routes and around, you know, between the hashes, 10 yards or shallower, you know, you can sit back and play them, but Travis is going to eat you alive. If you're just going to sit back and try to stop the deep ball, the big issue is Travis. And then the X factor outside of all of that is Andy Reid. He's always going to have something really with a motion, with a shift, some sort of quick screen. He's always going to do something to keep you on your toes as a defensive coordinator. So the combination of Travis Kelce working the underneath coverage in the middle of the field, and then you got Big Red calling plays from the sideline. I just don't think you can sit back and make them be patient, because they can still get you with Kelce.
What do you think of Trayvon Diggs for Defensive Player of the Year?
Well, I mean, if the season stopped right now, there's not a doubt about it. He'd win it. I mean, he just continuously finds ways to get the ball. And the other thing about him is there's a lot of DBs that you see and watch that they're going to drop a handful of picks. You know, they may end up going to the Pro Bowl with 7, 8, 9 picks, but they could have had 13 if they would have caught them all. That's the thing about Trayvon. The ball doesn't hit the ground. If he's got an opportunity to catch it, he makes the play. He completes the interception. He is like a receiver out there at defensive back.
But how often would you avoid a defensive back in your career?
It depends on who it was. I mean, if it was somebody
like Revis.
Revis could shut down half the field. And he was kind of similar to Trayvon. When the ball was in the air, Revis was going to catch it. There was very few balls that just bounced off of his fingertips. He had receiver-like hands. But if you got a Revis, or I played a bunch against Troy Polamalu and Ed Reed, and if it was Troy, we ran the ball away from him. If he rotated down to the left side of the field, we ran the ball to the right, vice versa. If it was Ed and Ed was double teaming a player or taking away a half of the field, I would just work the other side of the field. So Trayvon's that type of player. I mean, if Trayvon's lined up on your number one, regardless of who it is, you should be thinking of working the other side of the field, no doubt.
Dak Prescott talked about he had to move past this game. He got injured, you know, with his ankle, but and Drew Brees talked about this too, that you can't help but think about that injury. How long did it take you to move past when you got hurt against the Steelers?
You know, it just takes getting past that next game, because unfortunately for Dak, and you heard him say it after the game, he said, "I'm just glad this game is over with. I'm just glad I can get past it." And that's not a mental hurdle for him that he can't get over. It's just he's been asked about it week after week after week, and his teammates have been asked about it week after week. So it's just something that when it's constantly being asked of you, you may not be necessarily, you know, have a hurdle in your mind that you can't get past it. But when somebody's constantly reminding you, the New York Giants last year, you're playing the New York Giants in 3 weeks and 2 weeks and 1 week, it just naturally comes up in your head. So I think Dak can put this behind him. They're sitting at, I believe, 4-1 right now, one of the best offenses in the league. He's proven that he can take a hit, he can take off and run, he can step into throws. He's gotten that injury behind him, and I just expect him to continue to flourish as the season progresses.
What's your philosophy on quarterbacks trying to make tackles on interceptions, given what happened to Baker Mayfield?
You got to try. There's no doubt about it. I mean, when you make a mistake and you put the ball in the wrong place, or you didn't throw it on time and everybody else did their job correctly, there's an awful feeling as a quarterback when you throw that thing and it's starting to head in a different direction. And then you got your defense on the sideline that maybe is playing a great game, and they don't want that stat going on their side of the stat line, because those interceptions that end up being touchdowns, those end up counting as points against your defense. So every quarterback knows that. Every quarterback thinks about that. You don't have to make the tackle. You just got to make sure he doesn't get in the end zone. But you have to give effort. You have to try, or else you're going to hear it from every teammate.
Yeah, but, you know, when I see Tom Brady go in a fetal position when he's going to be sacked, or Peyton Manning kind of tries a little bit, but he doesn't want to touch that person who just picked him off. Like, those are guys that survived 20 years. You know, these guys who want to make the, like Baker Mayfield, you know, you want to stick somebody. Now he's got, you know, a damaged shoulder.
Yeah, Baker Mayfield's not Peyton Manning, and Baker Mayfield is not Tom Brady. Those guys have earned the right to make sure they stay healthy. I think Baker's 3, 4, 5 years and a number of statistics away from being able to be able to take kind of a hall pass on having to make a tackle.
How many tackles do you think you made in your career?
I had a couple good ones. I certainly missed more than I made, but I had a big chip on my shoulder. If I threw a pick and it was going the opposite direction, I wasn't worried about injury. I was worried about my teammates and letting them down. So I was giving everything I had. I was a terrible tackler. And now that I'm coaching football and I actually coach a lot of the defensive stuff, so I'm trying to talk about tackling and technique and form. And I can talk a good game, but as far as actually being able to execute it fundamentally and technically, I can't tackle.
Paulie, how many tackles did Carson have in his NFL career?
Oh, I'll get the good stuff first. 294 touchdown passes, Dan.
Okay.
That's a lot of touchdown
okay.
passes. I got one tackle.
See? I can tackle.
As a rookie.
Oh, it came as a rookie. Yeah,
hey, you just got to prove yourself once, right?
Do you think you put the fear, you know, of just that defense thinking, if I pick him off, and last thing I want is Carson Palmer to hit me?
I don't know. I threw a pick in Pittsburgh to Troy Polamalu. I think it was early on in my career, and he was my old roommate from college. And I don't know where he came from. I thought I had a nice, easy completion. And all of a sudden, I see this giant paw go up and one hand this catch. And I got knocked down. I turned around, and I was standing on my own goal line. And by the time I looked up, Troy was coming at me full speed. And all I could do was duck my head and put my arms up. And he ran me over. Actually, I still have a pain in my shoulder. He put his helmet right in my AC joint on my shoulder and ran me over for a pick six. And I think that was the one tackle.
Oh, wait, you get credit for that?
I got him on the ground.
In the end zone?
In the end zone, but he went to the ground.
Does he say anything to you after a play like that?
No, Troy never says anything to anybody. So if it was anybody else, they would probably be talking trash. But Troy never, I never heard Troy talk any trash in the field. If there's any football player that ever had the right to talk trash, it was probably Troy.
And you hear that voice. And if I say that, like Mike Tyson, where you go, hey, that's the baddest man on the planet, or that's a Hall of Fame defensive. Like, I would never think Troy Polamalu was one of those. I'm all over the field, like a yoga instructor. Troy is like my sensei or something.
Yeah, just a sweetheart off the field. But once guys like him or Mike Tyson get in the ring, they become pit bulls and you got to watch out.
But, you know, you get these guys, you can't be both, right? Like, you can't be crazy off the field and on the field, can you?
Yeah, I believe you can. I've played with a number of those.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You got any names?
Ocho was crazy off the field.
Like, how
crazy on the field?
How crazy was Chad Johnson off the field?
I mean, it depends on your definition of crazy. But I remember when Twitter first came out, Chad, and nobody really knew what Twitter was, but Chad was definitely on it. And Chad would go to the local mall in Cincinnati and send out a tweet saying, hey, I'm standing outside of Dick's Sporting Goods. And sure enough, 400 people show up and want to hang out. And then he'd take them all in and buy everybody a pair of shoes or, you know, do something. I guess that's not crazy. That's awesome. But he was just as crazy on the field as he was off. I mean, just as far as doing something you wouldn't expect. I wouldn't expect him to try to de-cleat Ray Lewis on the field, but he tried.
Hines Ward said that the Steelers were afraid of James Harrison.
I believe it. I believe it. I remember playing again in a game against James Harrison, and somebody got in a little bit of an altercation kind of after a play. There was a little bit of a scruffle, and I'll never forget Deshae Townsend came in. He was in the secondary. He came in out of the secondary, and Deshae was giving the Bengals, our team, a friendly warning, like, you do not want any of that. Back up right now. And it was out of, like, fear that one of us was going to get broken or snapped in half.
And chances are it'd be you.
No doubt. I was in James' crosshairs all the times.
Hey, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks, as always. And we look forward to next week.
Thank you.